sea, somewhere waiting for me. My lover stands on golden
sand. Welcome back, America. You're joined now by Admiral James Stavridis. He's down in Florida. Good morning, Admiral. Thank you, and welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Good to see you, Hugh.
Good to see you. Now, Admiral, I would like to talk to you a little bit about a conversation I had yesterday with former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates. My guess is you're a fan of his.
Oh, 100%. Of all the bosses I've had, I would put him at the very top of the list, Hugh. He's just terrific.
That's a pretty high praise. Why?
I'll give you three reasons. One, he is calm. He never loses his temper. He never blows up. And this is a guy who ran the CIA, was Secretary of Defense both for Bush and Obama. Think about that for a minute. Only time in history someone's made that turn between two parties to still be a Secretary of Defense. Yet he's always calm in the saddle. Number two, great sense of humor. Funny, clever, can use humor to diffuse a situation. And number three, he's got that spy master's gaze. You know, former head of the CIA, deeply perceptive, deeply intelligent, has a PhD in Russian studies. He's the whole package, Hugh.
So yesterday I talked to him at length in this kind of a setting where I was talking to him on Skype and going between two microphones. So I'm sorry I'm not looking at you sometimes, Admiral. And he said something that was arresting. He said, we are in Cold War 2.0 and that this one is more dangerous than the last one. Now, Bob Gates is the first person I've had who's been willing to say that. And I think he probably commands more Venn diagram respect, meaning between Democrats and Republicans, he's the guy that gets the most respect from both of them. What do you make of his willingness to go there?
Well, first of all, I assume you were talking to him about his new book, which is very, very good. It's about the use of American power in the world. Disclosure, I just did a book review of it for a magazine. I'm a big fan of the book. He kind of lays the tracks out for that in the book. On this one, though, I'm going to part company with the secretary. I think we're very close to Cold War 2.0. But here, I'm going to go with the deeply specialized knowledge on China of Henry Kissinger. And Kissinger has said, I think it's a good line, that we're in the foothills of a Cold War with China. We're at the very beginning. So maybe we're just splitting hairs here. I think we're probably still in a position to avoid plunging into a full-blown Cold War. And I'll close with this. Let's look back at what Cold War 1.0 looked like before we say we're in 2.0. 1.0 was hair trigger on the nuclear devices. 1.0 was millions of troops facing down across the Fulda Gap in Europe. 1.0 was two massive alliance systems lined up against each other, Warsaw Pact and NATO. And 1.0 was a world structure where there was almost no dialogue, no conversation between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. I don't think we're hitting all of those blocks yet, but we're close.
There is a new emerging alliance structure, which brings me to the second story. This happened on June 4, and I didn't have a chance to talk with you yet about it. I want to read to you. India and Australia signed two bilateral military agreements on June 4th in, quote, the first step in deepening of defense relationship between the two Indo-Pacific powers. All right. Now, most people don't talk Australia and India at the same time, but they are now linking up. What's the significance of that? And how exactly do you link up if you're Australia, which is, you know, half a world away from anywhere?
Well, if you look at that globe over my right shoulder, you'll see the Indian Ocean. And I often put that behind me when I'm speaking because I think the 21st century ocean that will matter the most may be the Indian Ocean by the latter part of the 21st century because of India, because of its confluence, and because it's a relatively untouched body of water. So how do they link up? First of all, look at the geography. They have a maritime corridor that connects them that's quite significant. Secondly, what motivates them to come together is their shared concern over China. And look at what's happened just last week, Hugh. Major conflict at the top of the Himalaya Mountains between China and India. And let me tell you something, that's not about the Himalayas per se. That's really about a global competition that at the moment is parked in that Indian Ocean region. And to finish this, you know, China's strategy, as you well know, is called One Belt, One Road. Well, One Belt, One Road has one big problem, and its one big problem is India. The geography is such that China will want to dominate or at least control India in this 21st century. Therefore, the Indians are shopping for allies. It's not only Australia, it's Japan and the United States. That's the building coalition.
Well, I love having the globe there, and thank you for having it there, Admiral, because people can, if you go back to the large shot, Ben, so we can get the globe in it. Australia, you can sail from Australia to India, but you got to go around Malaysia and Indonesia and all that different part. When India gets into a shooting match with China at the top of the world, which they did, a number of Indian soldiers were killed. What is Australia obliged to do? Anything? Or is it one of those defense pacts where we're just going to do some exercises together? Is it the beginning of a NATO in the Pacific, or is it really symbolic?
Boy, that's a big question that I think will unfold over the next decade or two. The idea of a collective alliance system in the Pacific. And of course, an alliance is where when one is attacked, it is an attack on all, the famous Article 5 in NATO. That does not exist yet. India does not have a treaty alliance with Australia. The United States does. The United States has treaty alliances with Japan, South Korea, Australia, New Zealand, the Philippines, Thailand. So there's the basics for a collective security pact. Over time, could that evolve into a kind of Pacific NATO? Maybe. And certainly it would be an Indo, as in Indian Ocean, Indo-Pacific NATO, because you would have to bring India into it. A final thought here. In the Indian Ocean last spring, big maritime exercise between India, Australia, Japan, and the United States. This is the wave, not to make a pun, this is the wave of the future. It'll start as a maritime kind of alignment, I think, Hugh.
No, Admiral Stavridis, when we say the Indian military, what are we talking about in terms of capacity? The Australian military has always punched above its weight for more than a century, part of the Imperial British forces, and a storied history. What about the Indian military?
The Indian military, first thing to know, is it is a nuclear power. It has high levels of professionalism. I've operated with them. I know the Indian military reasonably well. Their naval component is credible. They are certainly not at the level of China as yet. I would put them as a mid-level naval power with a room to grow. And they are doing this both in a smart way, both by producing ships indigenously in India, but also shopping the international markets. India is a comer in the world of defense. Australia is a small diamond of a country that does exceptional work. And I do some consulting for Northrop Grumman. We're involved in Australia, so I have good visibility into the Australian military, utterly professional, highly capable, keenly aware of the challenges of a growing Chinese military parked on their doorstep. Again, look at that globe. Australia is small and perfect. India is bigger, but growing and getting better. It's a pretty natural alignment to use the Jerry Maguire line. They kind of complete each other militarily. I could see a lot of upside in that relationship.
Okay, so last question, Admiral. There is this thing called the Five Eyes Agreement, which exists between Canada, New England, Australia, the United Kingdom, and America, the English-speaking countries, and we cooperate on intelligence. Do you foresee Japan and or India joining Five Eyes?
We are constantly looking at Five Eyes and thinking about who would be the logical nation or nations to bring into that super high level of intelligence. And you'll get different answers from different professionals. I'd be curious when I conclude if you ask Bob Gates this question, who of course really knows intel. I would say looking at the Five Eyes, the next nation I would think about bringing in may surprise you, but it would be Israel. which has terrific intelligence capability, obviously, long history in this area, very, very good. I think you'd also look at Japan as the next. And the logic there is both of them bring whole new components from regions where the U.S. could really benefit. Longer term, I think you look at some of our European allies, particularly the French and the Germans, potentially over time. And I think India, yes, at some point you would want to bring it in. I'll close by saying it's interesting to observe that the Five Eyes is, as you say, the English-speaking collection. It came out of the Commonwealth relationships, coming out of Great Britain. So there's a certain logic to India in that one as well.
But in Pakistan, they have the corruption problem with the ISI. I do not know anything about Indian intelligence. Do you, Admiral, do you have an opinion of it?
I would not leap to join with them at the moment for the corruption issues and the nuance issues and the loss of intelligence. I think the counterintelligence forces arrayed against India are significant coming from China. So I think you'd have to be very careful. That's why I put them further out in the orbit than I would, for example.
You froze up on us there, Admiral, a little bit. Okay. Quick last question. How often have you been to India, Admiral?
I've been there half a dozen times over the years, Hugh, which for me is not a huge number of times. Each visit, I come away more impressed with the trajectory.
Yeah, you're freezing up on
democracy. And they care, they're young, they're a democracy, and they care deeply about values. So I think India is a nation to watch and a potential significant ally for the United States over time.
You know, one of the things that people say, the only thing you can create by virtue of having population is data, but data is actually a natural resource. Now, India can produce as much data as China if they choose to use it, data powering artificial intelligence. But that requires a kind of comprehensive cooperation that we've never had with India. United Kingdom does. But do you see that in our military, a willingness to lean into the Indian relationship?
I think over time, the potential for that kind of cooperation is there with India. But let's face it, we're on the beach at Kitty Hawk in terms of where we are with artificial intelligence, data. You're correct. Data is regarded as the new oil. The more you have, you can drive artificial intelligence, therefore machine learning in real time. Crucial. We're still regard that as crown jewel material. We're going to hold that very closely. Would be better served cooperating, for example, with the United Kingdom on that rather than moving toward India at this point.
Admiral James Stavridis, always a pleasure. Follow him on Twitter at Stavridis or to his website, admiralstav.com, and you'll get all that Admiral Stavridis writes. Thank you, Admiral.